Thank you very much. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm really delighted to be here. I visited the university, 15 years ago, I think, when I was visiting Professor Desai's group. And it's very nice to be back here and to meet with some people whose work I've followed for a long time and to catch up with some old friends. So as Mary said, I'm going to talk today about work that my group is doing on packing and assembling polyhedra. And you might ask, why are we interested in studying polyhedra? But let's start by reminding ourselves what we mean when we say polyhedra. So polyhedra are faceted shapes. Those are the simplest, the Platonic solids. Where is it? There it is. Okay. So the simplest ones are the Platonic solids. They're regular polyhedra because all the facets are the same and all the vertices are identical. And so those are the simplest kinds of faceted shapes. And the reason why we became interested in faceted shapes is because I sit in an engineering college at the University of Michigan. My group is made up of physicists and chemical engineers, material scientists, mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, chemists, applied mathematicians. I'm forgetting somebody. Computer scientists. And we all come together around in the general area of nanoscience and self-assembly. So we're very interested in how you build structures by starting with building blocks at length scales that are larger than individual atoms and even larger than molecules, but still smaller than microscopic, okay, at this length scale that's about the size of, say, a fraction of a red blood cell or about the size scale of, say, the width of a DNA double helix. We want to know if you can manipulate matter at that scale, what can you do? What kinds of cool new materials could you build out of structures by working at that length scale? And it turns out, that's the wrong direction. Sorry. Okay, so it turns out that it is possible, not by us, but by groups who actually make things, to make nanoparticles, which are these small particles on these sorts of nanometer length scales of all kinds of shapes, many of which are polyhedra. And this is just a snapshot of some of them that are in the literature today. There's all sorts of polyhedral rods, and here you can see cubes. These are cool little, some kind of concave faceted shapes. These are really interesting dipyramids. Here, there's some other kind of facet shapes. Rhombic dodecahedra are very, very popular. These are some of the first kinds of shapes that were made by Olivasatos' group about 10 or 12 years ago. There are lots and lots of examples of different kinds of polyhedra. Today, I was visiting with Professor Kumacheva, who showed me all these new kinds of polyhedral particles that she could make out of silver and other things. What's cool about these shapes is that they can be made today out of basically any kind of material, metals, semiconductors, even polymers, plastics can be made into shapes like these and even more exotic shapes. And they can be made on length scales that go from just a couple of nanometers up to thousands of nanometers. And even more than that, it's possible to decorate the surfaces of these kinds of new particles with different kinds of molecules, organic ligands, DNA molecules, proteins. You can paint one side of the particle, say take a polymeric particle that's made of, say, polystyrene or PMMA and coat half of it with gold. And there's been just an enormous advances over the past decade in what is possible from a synthetic chemistry, materials chemistry point of view in making these new kinds of building blocks out of which one can imagine making new kinds of materials. And so that's how we got started in thinking about polyhedra, because all of my colleagues down the hall from me were making these kinds of particles and saying, what should we do with them? How can we put them together? How will these shapes fit together? And so So the reason why we want to understand how they fit together is because if we can imagine how to fit them together into exotic kinds of structures, then we can start to think about making materials that are really different than the materials that we see around us. Most of the materials we see around us are static. It is what it is. It has a, you know, it's some hard plastic. It doesn't change with time. It's not responsive to its environment. It serves its purpose, but it's not super highly functional. If we think about kind of futuristic applications, we think about things like soft robotics. Soft robotics, a great example is from the Terminator movies. I think it's the T3. Is it the T3, the guy that comes out of the ground, like he's a big blob and then he comes out like this? Okay, imagine that you have a material that can be, that is some kind of goop, and then all of a sudden it solidifies into the shape that you want. That's coming, by the way, with big advances that are coming in 3D printing techniques, which is another cool thing. I think, I'm just gonna say this, I think 3D printing is gonna be as revolutionary as the internet. Just wait for it. Because it's going to be possible to literally, next to your microwave in your kitchen, have a thing that prints whatever you want. And towards the end of the talk, I'll try to get back to how 3D printing, where you're trying to design stuff from the top down, meets the self-assembly of these little particles from the bottom up. And so we want to understand how to take a material and get it to change its phase, change its structure, be liquid, be solid, be a structured solid, have this kind of a shape, have that kind of shape. And to do that, we need to be able to control matter on this very small lane scale. We're also interested in things like wet memory, so beyond silicon computing, beyond silicon storage, where you think about having the ability to store high density of information in fluidic components, right? This is important in the area of soft robotics. We're interested in making materials that can give something a certain appearance that may be different than the actual thing. So you think about cloaking devices, like Klingon cloaking devices. And yes, I know that it's Romulan technology and that the Klingons stole it from the Romulans, but whatever. My generation knows it as Klingon cloaking. The previous generation knew it as Romulan cloaking. But so imagine that you have a material, and because of its structure, it can bend light in ways that are not the usual way that you expect light to be reflected off of the surface. And so it makes something that's over there look like it's over there, or makes something that's over there not appear at all, or can change colors, like camouflage, like the way that an octopus can change its colors based on environmental cues and surges of chemicals. These are all opportunities for new kinds of function by being able to understand at some scale, at some limit, how do you put materials together at these small line scales. And then there's a lot of other examples of applications that we have in mind when we study these, what you'll see are some really pretty fundamental problems in packing and assembling shapes. And so I'm from Michigan now, so I would be remiss to not show this picture from the Ford assembly line, where the assembly line was invented. It's about 19, this is a picture from 1920, which shows, you know, this assembly line which revolutionized manufacturing, because it said, okay, you put this on, now you do this, you do this, and the whole thing was a sequential process, but you could have a lot of them in parallel, and you could build things up. The problem with thinking about working at the nanoscale and trying to make, say, 20 nanometer silver nanocubes like Professor Kumacheva and her students can make, is that if you wanted to build up a structure from them and you tried to place them one after another after another, and imagine you just wanted to make a 2-centimeter cube out of those little silver nanocubes that she could make, then you need something of the order of 10 to the 20 nanoparticles. And if you actually place them one by one, sequentially, even if you could do 1 million a second, it would take about 25,000 years to build that up. Okay, so mechanically, sequentially assembling structures out of nanoparticles is not a reasonable thing to do, and that's how we don't make things out of atoms that way anyway. Things self-assemble, which means that somehow the particles, just like atoms and molecules, interact with forces, and those forces dictate how those particles want to come together under different thermodynamic conditions. And so that's what we want to be able to take advantage of for nanoparticles. And so here's just one example. This is a beautiful picture from Peidong Yang's group in the chemistry department at UC Berkeley that they published in Nature Materials about 2 years ago. These are octahedrally shaped particles. So octahedra is one of the platonic shapes, and he just has a bucket of them, and they self-assemble into this kind of structure, which I'll talk about later. It's a very complicated crystal structure with a repeat unit that actually has 16 particles in it. So in material science, we call that a unit cell. That means that if I can identify what the repeat pattern is, then I can just keep translating it and build up the crystal that you see. And it turns out that for this particular crystal structure, there are 16 particles in the repeat unit. So it's considered a pretty complicated crystal structure. For the material scientists in the audience, this is the high-pressure lithium phase. It's a bipartite lattice with two interpenetrating crystal structures that are identical. So it's a complicated structure, and it's built entirely of octahedra that started out in octahedra suspended in a fluid with no structure whatsoever, and then it was dried so that the solution was taken out, and the particles come together and pack, and this is what they make. And so the questions that my group asks is, can we predict that? Can we predict that kind of crystal structure? And if we understand what controls octahedra into assembling into some complicated crystal structure like that, how far can we go in predicting new kinds of structures for new kinds of materials? And so this problem we're talking about nanoscience, so it sounds sort of funny to say that this has some connections to one of the oldest problems, which is the sphere packing problem. And the sphere packing problem, how many of you have heard of the sphere packing problem? Okay, so now I know who the mathematicians are. So the sphere packing problem is, you see it every time you go into a supermarket. You just don't think of it as a sphere packing problem, but you will never look at a stack of oranges the same way again, I guarantee you. So if you look at the way that you would stack round fruit, for example, and you want to know what's the most efficient way. I have a small space, I have these spherical objects, and I want to pack them as densely as possible so I can fit as many as possible in there. And this is a problem. How to pack this is important. It's important in foodstuffs. It was important to the British in understanding how to pack cannonballs on a ship in a hold. They want to build a hold of a certain size. How many cannonballs can we fit in there? So it comes up over and over. And there are actually Sanskrit writings that go back to 499 CE or AD that talk about this problem in different words, of course, of sphere packings. Kepler was the first to really work on this. And he conjectured that the densest you could possibly pack spheres was with a packing fraction of pi over the square root of 18. And that was the number that he came up with. And that says that if I just start stacking them up, the densest I could possibly fill my box is pi over the square root of 18. And then Hales proved this. He was a professor in the math department at the University of Michigan, where I am now, but he left to go to the University of Pittsburgh. I have no idea why. But when he was at Michigan, he proved that Kepler was right, but he showed that the packing fraction is in fact 74.05%, and so that is the densest that you can pack spheres. And it turns out that the densest packing of spheres is obtained by ordering them into something called a face-centered cubic crystal structure. So face-centered cubic means, imagine that I make a cube by putting spheres at the corners of a cube. So I have eight spheres at the corners of a cube, and I put another sphere in the middle of every one of the faces. That's a face-centered cubic crystal structure. It's a super common crystal structure that's found for all sorts of materials, all sorts of elements, very common in metals, and even in other kinds of soft materials. And so that's that structure. That's basically the FCC, or sometimes we call it hexagonal closed pack. There are some subtle differences, but that's not so important for this. Okay, so that's how spheres pack. And here's a periodic table of elements. I'm not sure why the colors are so... Let me just make sure all my pins are connected. Well, whatever. there's a light green color that's not coming out. But anyway, all the ones basically that are white, I think, they used to be light green. Anyway, those are examples of all these elements that crystallize into a face-centered cubic crystal structure. Some of them make more complex structures like boron and manganese. They can form much more complicated crystal structures. That high-pressure lithium phase was an example with the 16 particles. That's a super complicated crystal structure. All the ones that are outlined in red under pressure, like lithium, can form a complex crystal structure. And what kinds of structures atoms will tend to naturally form when they crystallize, and its relation to the packing problem was, I think, first studied by Linus Pauling, who tried to explain the packings of atoms and metals, or tried to explain the crystal structures of why you get sometimes face-centered cubic and body-centered cubic in terms of the packing of spheres and how many smaller spheres you can pack around a bigger sphere, et cetera. And that was work that he did way before the whole vitamin C crazy stuff. And so now this problem is being revisited from the point of view of shape, because if we know that we change the question, if we say, okay, so now instead of packing spheres, I want to pack some other shape. And we know from common everyday experience that the shape of whatever it is you're packing matters as to how efficiently you can pack it. If I have a suitcase and I want to pack a bunch of baseballs in there, I know already from Kepler and Hales that I can't get more than that fill more than 74.05% of my suitcase, right? So 5% is going to be empty. But if I have books, which are nice and flat, they stack very nicely, and I can line them all up, then I'll be able to fill my suitcase with far less space left over, right? That's just a common thing that we realize. And of course, packing is something that's super important to a bunch of industries that we care about as consumers, that chemical engineers actually think about, which is, you know, how do you maximize the shape of M&Ms. We were talking about Paul Chaykin's group at NYU and how they study M&Ms. If you walk into his office, he's got a giant barrel of M&Ms. It's always full of M&Ms, which is weird because, like, people walk in, they put their hand in, they take out the M&Ms. But anyway, but you can always get a quick chocolate fix by going into his office. But the shape of an M&M is important, because if you change the shape of an M&M and you keep the packaging the same, you might be able to put more or fewer M&Ms in the package. So it's important to understand how stuff fits into things. These Toblerones, right, these pack really nicely when you go up, down like this. And these are these other kinds of candies that, you know, where you think about the packaging. And of course, in the pharmaceutical industry, packing is huge, because you want to know, as you change the shape of the pill, you know, if you look at whatever, Advil and Aleve, and Tylenol and aspirin, they all have these different shapes, right? Like, there's this telltale shape of a leaf. And they fit them into containers that have a certain shape. And how many you can put in and have it fill a certain volume fraction so that the consumer doesn't say, this is so empty, there's nothing in here. You want to know how these things pack. And then you even want to know how they pack if you're trying to make time-release pills, and make a gelatin capsule like this that's filled with smaller grains. You want to know how many of them can I pack in there? How big do I have to make my pill versus how tiny those little grains are? So these kind of packing problems come up all over. This is a real honest to God picture of a square watermelon that the Japanese have pioneered because watermelon pack terribly, right? I mean, they're, you know, how, you go in the market and you see, like, there's so much room in the bin with the watermelons, but if you could actually grow them square, then you could pack them much more efficiently. So they do this, I swear. I think it would be weird for us. You can do this with tomatoes too, but I don't want to eat a square tomato. I'll be honest with you. Okay, so we got interested in then the packing of shapes, and we got interested in it in a totally different way. I was talking with Steve Morris, and it turns out that Steve Morris was the first graduate student of one of my favorite all-time Hungarian physicists, Peter Palffy Mohori, at Kent State University. And Peter Palffy is a liquid crystal scientist, soft matter scientist, and he and I had a grant from the Air Force where we were trying to make negative index materials. So these are materials whose structure is such that it bends light kind of backwards, and people are interested in this for cloaking. And so we had this idea that we could make super chiral structures, so structures that had a handedness like DNA, but we could maybe make them out of out of nanoparticles. And my colleague next door to me, Nick Kotoff, who's a good friend and colleague of Professor Kumacheva's, he happened to be making little cadmium telluride, cadmium selenide nanoparticles that grow naturally, atomically, as little tetrahedra. So we thought, oh, let's see, if we could get the tetrahedra to pack in a certain way, you know, maybe they will form these chiral structures. And at some point, Peter and I were talking, and we said, you know, I don't even know how tetrahedra want to pack if I just try to fit them together. So we were trying to make these chiral structures, and I thought, well, I don't even know how they want to fit together, like if I asked about the maximum packing fraction. And so we just started studying this. And basically, so my group does computer simulations, and so we do molecular dynamics, Monte Carlo simulations. These are simulations that exploit the laws of statistical mechanics. And basically, like in the kind of simulations that I'm going to show you, you have a box and you throw your particles in. And we have in our minds that our particles are suspended perfectly in a solution in which they're perfectly density matched, and then they're jostled around by the molecules in the fluid, because the particles are bigger than the molecules in the fluid, but not that big. And so they're floating around, and all we want to do is move the particles like this so they can translate around and they can rotate around, and if they come close, they can collide. And those are the only interactions we want to think about. And all we do is change the density. We just crowd them more and more and more. And so we did that with tetrahedra. And so before I show you what forms, so Aristotle actually, I think, had some of the earliest writings on how tetrahedra pack. So this is a translation by Guthrie from 1986, in which he mentions here figures which fill the place that contains them, the triangle, the square, and the hexagon, that's in two dimensions, among solids only two, the pyramid and the cube. And apparently, scholars say that by pyramid, he actually was not talking about a square pyramid, but he was talking about the tetrahedron. Now, cubes, of course, completely fill space, right? So whereas spheres will leave, you know, all this empty space because I can only pack them at 74.05%, cubes will fill space perfectly, right? Because I can fill up all space with them. But the tetrahedron, Aristotle thought, actually tiled space, but it doesn't. And you can see this. So this is the first experiment my group ever did. We bought these Dungeons and Dragons dice, which you can get for like 10 cents a die, which is kind of expensive. But we got them for 6 cents a die when we bought them in bulk. So we bought like 10,000 of these. And then we got modeling putty from the local store, and you know, the sticky stuff that doesn't stick permanently. And then we all sat around and stuck these things together, and you can see by looking at this. So if I take five tetrahedral Dungeons and Dragons dice, they look like they fit together pretty well, but there are some gaps, and you can kind of see the blue modeling putty. The modeling putty makes it look like there's not really a lot of gaps, but there are. If they were perfectly face to face, there would actually be a little gap of like 7 degrees or so. And then if you make a nonomer out of them, which is you know, one of these pentagonal dipyramids, and then you take four more and you put them at 90 degrees, then you can start to see the gaps are getting kind of worse. And then this is an icosahedron. There are 10 around the sides, and there are these pentagonal dipyramid caps top and bottom. And it turns out that there's gaps there. The bigger the object, the bigger the gaps. There's about 1.54 steradians of gap in there. And then you start gluing stuff or sticking stuff to the outside of your icosahedron. You build up a hexacontahedron. But you can see how it starts to get worse. The gaps start opening up. And the bigger you make this object, the worse it gets. Okay. And so you cannot fill space with perfectly tile space with tetrahedra. And it turns out that this is kind of a big deal. I mean, to like 30 of us, it's a big deal. But it was the focus of a ton of effort. So if you start with Aristotle back in 330 BCE, then it was actually Johannes Mueller, a.k.a. Regiomontanus, who pointed out in the 1400s that, no, they don't actually tile space. And then a number of people worked on it. The famous mathematician Hilbert was fascinated by the problem. He has a list, Hilbert's list of interesting math problems that he finds important. And it's a special case of problem number 18 on Hilbert's list of important math problems. And then Gromer and Hoylman looked at it. Minkowski, the famous Minkowski, looked at it. And they asked, what's the densest I could possibly pack tetrahedra? And they assumed that it was, they said, well, if we assume it's a lattice packing, which means a crystal structure with one particle in the repeat unit, then that's the densest you could pack. So that's a pretty low density. And then who I don't have on here is but I should put on here is Stanislaw Ulam, also a famous mathematician, said, you know, if I think about all the convex shapes, I bet spheres are the worst packers. Meaning if I had any other shape, a cube, a tetrahedron, a pyramid, an augmented, truncated, gyro, whatever, convex shape, they would all pack more densely, more efficiently than the sphere. But the question was, what about tetrahedra? And so the mathematician Conway at Princeton, working with his colleague Sal Torquato, they looked at this problem. They said, well, if we wanted to do it really densely, let's pack them all in icosahedra, and we'll stick icosahedra in a box and see how densely we could pack that. And they weren't able to find packing fractions that were denser than spheres. So until 2007, it was thought that maybe tetrahedra violated Ulam's conjecture, which is kind of cool because they're the simplest 3D convex shape, and the fact that they might violate this rule was sort of interesting. But then this brilliant young mathematician by the name of Elizabeth Chen came along. Elizabeth, we met her totally by accident. We were both working on tetrahedra, and then I found her paper, and she was like right there in our math department. So she was a student in our math department. She worked with Jeff Ligarius. And he put her on this problem of trying to analytically figure out what's the densest packing of tetrahedra. And her approach to doing it was to basically construct it and then compute it. And so she found a packing of tetrahedra in the form of those nonomers, those two intersecting pentagonal dipyramids, that if you stack them in a box with an alternating AB stacking, she was able to prove that packing could be packed as densely as 77.86%. So that was a big deal because it was the very first demonstration that mathematically, yes, tetrahedral could pack better than spheres. And then it became this ridiculous flurry of activity because we started coming at it from this other point of view of we wanted to make materials. We didn't even realize that the packing problem was so cool because we hadn't even worked on it before. And so we came at it from that point of view of asking, what does thermodynamics do? What are the forces between the particles? What kind of structures want to come out naturally? And the mathematicians were saying, well, but what's the densest we can pack them? And we were both coming at it from these different extremes. And so there was this. So if you look here, you see, you know, millennia, and then centuries, and then you have to go to years 2007, 2009. And then you have to go to October 27, 2009, and 27 December 2009. What's what? 21 December, 27 December. This last result is what I call how I spent my Christmas vacation in 2009. But it started from a really bright guy by the name of Yoav Kallis, who's now a postdoc at Princeton, who is on the market looking for a faculty position right now, assistant professor. He's brilliant. Math department, look at him. Yoav Kallis was working with his thesis advisor, Veit Elser, at Cornell, and they were looking at how to pack tetrahedra, and they came up with this brilliant, elegant packing that said, you know, if you just take two tetrahedra and you build a little dimer out of them, and then you take those dimers and you just stack them, you get a dimer packing, and they were able to show analytically that had a packing fraction of 85.47%. So that was like a big, crazy deal because it was huge. So much better packing than spheres, that actually the community was very excited about that. And then Torquato's group came and they sort of tweaked this and with a different symmetry and got up to, where's the number, 85.55%. And then Elizabeth Chen and my student and my postdoc Michael Engel got together and came up with a slightly different packing of 85.63%, which reigns as the current world record for packing of hard tetrahedra. So if you're ever on, I don't know, you know, Jay Leno, is he still on the air? I don't know, like that. If someone stops you on the street and asks you, what is the densest you can possibly pack tetrahedra? You will know. The answer is 85.63%. Now, this is not a proof. There is no proof that that is the densest. That we can prove that if we have this, if we set the particles up in a certain packing, which I'll show you, that is the density of that packing. But the only proof is that we have is from Callis and Elser, which tells us that there's an upper bound of one. None of the mathematicians are laughing at that. That's important. Okay, so I told you it was like a big crazy thing. The New York Times ran a story on this. I kid you not. January 4, 2010, Science Times Tuesday or whatever, the New York Times, every Tuesday there's a science section. Kenneth Chang wrote this, packing tetrahedra closing in a perfect fit, the new world packing record. So he wrote about this whole story in this newspaper. So for 1 week, this was the story, the science story of the decade for this one week, as crazy as it sounds. So this was the dimer packing that was proposed by Callis and Elser, where you take two tetrahedra, put them together, get these dimers, and so it's it has four particles in the unit cell. Oops, sorry, I went backwards. And so that was that's what you can find if you look at their archive paper, Torquato and Zhao. There's their packing. Then there's our packing, which we found numerically by putting tetrahedra in a box and packing them. And then Elizabeth Chen was able to show analytically. And I challenge you to spot the difference between these three, but they all have these different packing fractions. They're slightly different because this one's a trigonal packing, this is a monoclinic packing, and this is a triclinic packing. But they're slightly different, but it matters to the packing fraction. Okay. But then we found this super crazy thing. I'm going to go faster. So we said, okay, so this is how tetrahedra pack. So we threw a bunch of tetrahedra in a box, and instead of just packing, we said, let's keep the box with 50% space in it, and we're just going to let them jostle around, and we're going to let the particles figure out on their own thermodynamically what they want to do. Now, thermodynamics says that, so whenever you have a system that obeys the laws of thermodynamics, we know that there's a variational principle that is being satisfied, and in this case, it's that the free energy of the system is minimized. And free energies come, there's lots of different contributions to free energies. There's the interactions, the forces between the particles, pressure and volume come into it, if you're talking about enthalpy. And then there's entropy. Entropy plays a really important role. We're going to talk about entropy in a second. In these systems where they're hard particles, and we're assuming that there's no other forces other than just excluded volume, they just can't overlap the same space, then the only thing you have in the problem is entropy, and the system will tend to maximize entropy. Okay, so we're going to come back to that in a second. We threw these particles in a box, ran the simulation, and this came out. Okay, so what is that? So we started to slice and dice it. Here's like an X, Y, Z, so that I can look at projections, cuts through it, and see what I get. And it turns out that this, at 50% packing fraction, thermodynamically, hard tetrahedra want to self-assemble into this crazy structure, which is what's called a dodecagonal quasicrystal. And the structure, here you can look at it from the top, is they form, five of them come together and make a little pentagonal dipyramid. And then 12 of them come together and make a little ring like the ring around an icosahedron, only with 12 tetrahedrons instead of 10. And then there's another pentagonal dipyramid, and then another ring, and another dipyramid, another ring. And they make these stacks, these logs. And then the logs stand up next to each other, and they shift a little bit. And so looking down the axis of the log is looking down through this pentagonal dipyramid. And then here it is looking at it from the side. You can see these stacks. And the way we figured out what it was not from, because we didn't have this picture at first. We just looked at it and we said, what is that? It looks like a mess, but it kind of looks ordered. So we colored everything a different color and made it translucent so we could see through it, because we said if anything's lined up, then we'll see a bunch of black lines from the edges lining up. And so then we saw this and we saw all of these rings. And it turned out that this was kind of a pretty picture. And so it was the BBC News Image of the Week on December 14th, 2009, because they thought it was cool too. And this is, so crystallographers, if they're trying to figure out what a crystal structure is, will do, will measure a diffraction pattern that they get by scattering X-rays off of a crystal. And so this is what you get by looking at in what's called reciprocal space. It tells you, if you look at where the peaks are, it tells you what kind of order you have in your system. And so if you see something that has all these peaks like that, Bragg peaks, it tells you, I have a crystal. There's order in my system. What's special about quasicrystals is that they have a special kind of order. So this one has 12 peaks in every ring, another 12 peaks, another 12 peaks. From a crystallography point of view, this is a really clean diffraction pattern. It's because we can get it with a lot of statistics from our computer simulations, but it helps us figure out what this structure is. And so I'll quickly mention that. So this is due solely to entropy. I'm going to explain that in a second. It turns out that you can even get this structure if your particles aren't perfect. And I said that right after Eugenia left the room. Because she'll want to know this. But maybe her students are here. Are students here? Somebody? Awesome. So you can make these if your tetrahedra aren't perfect. They can be a little truncated. They can be up to 8% polydispersity. Look how nice that diffraction pattern looks. You guys could do 8%, right? That's like no big deal. You can make them. See, it's easy as a simulator to say it's no big deal to make those things. They can be a little rough. They can be a little rounded. They can be a little soft. They don't have to be perfectly hard. They can have ligands on the surface, make them a little squishy. This turns out that this structure is super robust, and that tetrahedra should want to self-assemble into these structures. Now, the reason why quasicrystals are so cool and why we're so surprised is that quasicrystals are things that they're aperiodic crystals. They don't have a repeat unit. You look at them and you say, that is clearly ordered. But there is no repeat unit you can find that if you translate, you get the crystal. It doesn't exist. So it doesn't have long-range translational order, but it has long-range rotational order. And the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was just given in 2011 to Dan Shechtman for his discovery of the quasicrystal. This is one of his NIST notebooks. I also have a lot of these green NIST notebooks, where he marked down all of the different scattering peaks that he was seeing, trying to figure out why he was finding the kinds of patterns that he was getting. So what's weird is that these things are mostly seen in metals. They're also seen in some soft materials, but really most of these exotic kinds of quasicrystals are found in metal alloys, things with vanadium and nickel and aluminum. And there's a particular one called it's made of tantalum tellurium. This is a quasicrystalline chalcogenide. And this is what its diffraction pattern looks like. And this is the positions of the atoms. This is the invert, this is the scattering pattern. And it turns out that if you take our scattering pattern and just rotate it, you can put it right on top of that scattering pattern, which means that our hard tetrahedra with no forces whatsoever, just jiggling around, just hard particle interactions, are naturally thermodynamically self-assembling to exactly the same structure as this tantalum tellurium alloy. And so this was kind of a big thing for the quasicrystalline community, because they felt that, well, you have to have long-range metallic bonding in order to have quasicrystal, and it turns out not so much. You could actually get it just from hard particles. And so that's really interesting to understand how this kind of long-range order can arise spontaneously out of stuff that is only interacting when it touches, really short range interactions. And so so I want to say a couple words about entropy, because we're all familiar with van der Waals interactions and covalent bonding, hydrogen bonding, ionic bonding, metallic bonding. These are the usual kinds of forces that chemists and physicists think about when we try to understand what holds matter together. But there's another force, which is like a statistical force, entropy, which is not really a force. But we say that because it can drive systems to organize, like these tetrahedra. And entropy was first proposed by Ludwig Boltzmann. He said, you know, entropy is just the number of ways that you can arrange stuff. So right now, everyone's sitting in their seat, and I can call that's what we call in statistical mechanics a microstate of the system. It's one way of organizing all of you into chairs. But if I took you and had you move over there and you moved over there, that would be another way of arranging you. And if I took everyone from the back row and put them in the front, that's another way of arranging you. And I could do that, and you could imagine that that's a very, very large number of ways. You know, at whatever 100 factorial, I don't know how many are in the room, ways of organizing all of you. And all of those ways contribute to the entropy of a system. And Boltzmann said, well, the entropy is just the logarithm of the number of those ways. And here on his tomb in Vienna, you can see it says x equals log omega is written on his tomb. So it was kind of important. He thought it was important back then. The thing about entropy is that many people associate entropy with disorder, but it's not the right way to think about it. Really, we should think about entropy as having to do with options. Systems that want to increase their entropy want to increase their options. And the reason why it's important to think in terms of options and not just automatically equating entropy with disorder is that entropy can order stuff if there are more ways of being ordered than there are being disordered. And this was shown by Lars Onsager in 1949 and by Kirkwood. Actually, he predicted this in the 30s, and then it was shown in one of the very first molecular dynamics simulation by Alder and Wainwright in 1957 that, yes, in fact, entropy can order things if there are more ways of being ordered than not ordered. So if I just replay this, so here's some hard rods on the right, and these are hard spheres on the left. And when they're red, there's no local order with their neighbors around them. And we color them green as soon as there now starts to be some registry or some tendency for alignment in the case of the rods. And so the system's turning from red to green means I set them up, that everything was totally disordered, and I let them move around, they feel each other, and then the system realizes, you know what? I can increase my entropy if I organize. On the left, into a face-centered cubic crystal structure, and on the right, just into a nematic phase where these rods are lined up. So in fact, what the system does is, and this is what Onsager showed, is that the rods will give up rotational entropy to gain translational entropy because there's more ways that the whole system can arrange itself, right? So it's like if you have a bunch of pencils and they're all pointing every which way on the floor and you start to sweep them together and you get them more and more crowded. At some point, they're going to line up, right? Otherwise, they're going to jam. It's a similar kind of idea here. Oh, that just went backwards. So I'm just going to point out really quick and then I'm going to go through 30 slides in 2 seconds. No, I'm just going to conclude. But first, I want to point out that, because I just think this is a fun story, that so Kirkwood and Onsager were both in the chemistry department at Yale. Do you know this, right? And I don't think they got along. Okay, but so Kirkwood, a brilliant chemist, so on his tombstone, so they're buried together next to each other in a cemetery in New Haven, Connecticut. And this is Kirkwood's tombstone. He died first, and it has basically every title he's ever held and every award he ever won, every honor he ever get. And I don't know why it's blank, but maybe they were expecting some posthumous awards. But what's awesome about Onsager's is, so this is Onsager. So Onsager passed away in, what does that say? 1991? Really? No, 1976, sorry. 1976, he passed away. And what it says right there, I don't know if you can see it, it says Nobel laureate, asterisk, etc. So this kind of entropy stuff is very serious business. So I realize that I have to stop. So I'm just going to say what we've been obsessed with now in my group is saying, okay, so how far can we take all of this? How far can we take this idea of entropy and shapes and packing and get all of these interesting crystal structures just from entropy alone? And how does the structures that are preferred by thermodynamics and by entropy, how does that relate to the densest packings that I can get? And so we've been carrying out all these different studies. I have a student, Pablo Shotgun Damasceno, and he studied all of the other platonic solids and the Archimedeans and the Catalan solids, all these different polyhedra, 145 different polyhedra. We just did the whole study of the tetrahedra over and over and over for all of these different shapes, and we're able to classify them into all kinds of different crystal structures. Here are some of the crystal structures that you get, and I'll just show them to you really quickly. This is a cool one where pyramids, square pyramids form a cube, and the cubes make bigger cubes, and they make bigger cubes, and it's hierarchical, and it's all just from maximizing entropy in these systems. And so this is something that we didn't really know about these kinds of shapes, and it has a lot of relevance for nanoscience in trying to design the shape of nanoparticles to assemble new kinds of structures that we're interested in. So in the interest of time, I'll stop there and see if anyone has questions. Thanks very much.